Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 163 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is, for my money, the greatest actress of her generation. A 35-year-old who has been called the queen of peak TV because she's been such an integral part of the medium's platinum age. From NBC's The West Wing, to AMC's Mad Men, to Sundance TV's Top of the Lake, to Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale, the last of which she currently produces and stars on, and which could finally bring her first Emmy on her eighth nomination in September. The extraordinary Elizabeth Moss. Moss first began popping up on screens big and small at the age of 6, but her first major role came at the age of 17, when Aaron Sorkin hired her to play Zoe Bartlett, the first daughter, on The West Wing. She was a recurring character on that massively acclaimed drama series, appearing in 25 episodes between 1999 and 2006, and almost immediately after it came to an end, Matthew Weiner hired her to play Peggy Olson, a young woman who starts as a secretary and begins climbing the ranks at an ad agency in the 60s on Mad Men. Over the course of 88 episodes of that drama series, between 2007 and 2015, Olsen became a feminist hero and Moss became a star. During hiatuses, she kept busy with theatrical productions, films, and most notably, the limited series Top of the Lake, for which Jane Campion cast her as a detective, and for which Moss won a Golden Globe in 2014. Post-Mad Men, Moss returned to that role in a second limited series that currently is rolling out across Europe and will arrive stateside in September, and also signed up to do The Handmaid's Tale, a drama series that rolled out between April and June, taking the TV world by storm. It's an adaptation of Margaret Atwood's 1985 dystopian novel about a totalitarian society in what used to be America, where infertility has skyrocketed and fertile women are renamed and made to serve as sexual slaves or handmaids of the ruling elite. Moss plays Offred, formerly June, who is one of those women. Over the course of our conversation at the Sunset Tower Hotel, Moss and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how her career evolved from bit parts as a kid to a recurrent part on The West Wing as an adolescent to her first job as a series regular as an adult on Mad Men, and how that show changed everything for her. Why, so soon after Mad Men ended, she was convinced that she should return to TV with both the second installment of Top of the Lake and another open-ended drama series in Handmaids. How the styles and approaches of her various TV collaborators, from Sorkin to Weiner to Campion to Handmaid's Bruce Miller, compare and contrast with one another, and how she adapted to each of them. When the election of Donald Trump happened in relation to the production of Handmaids, and how his administration's approach to women's rights has made Handmaids feel all the more prescient and urgent, why she regards her part on Top of the Lake as her greatest departure, but her part in Handmaids as her greatest challenge, plus much more. So, without further ado, praise be, and let's go to that conversation. Elizabeth, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. We always just begin with basic. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I am born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and my parents are both musicians in the jazz, really, mostly. And my mom is a jazz and blues harmonica player. So, nice. Yeah.
If what I'm reading is correct, you did your first professional job at 6. How does somebody get started that young?
Yeah, I think I did maybe commercials before that too. Yeah, so it may have been even a little bit sooner. But yeah, I think I've heard tell that I was a rugrat on a Kids in the Hall.
Even before that.
Yeah.
Because like, this age six thing was this Jackie Collins miniseries.
Yeah, that was like my first, I guess, like real, you know, job or job on television.
But we can go and spot you.
Yes.
Earlier than that.
Yes.
So what, how does that begin?
Well, I actually went to a ballet school in the Valley when I was really little because I did ballet till I was 15 and we did The Sound of Music, as all ballet schools do. And I played the littlest one. And there was an agent there, and she approached my mom and said, if you are interested and she wants to go out on auditions, that might be great. And I think I was, sort of just into it, and I kept being into it. My mom kept checking in with me and saying over the years, when I was younger, and saying, is this something that you still like? And I did. So, yeah, it just seemed very natural. I was always a performer and very interested in being on stage. So,
and the dancing continued throughout, like simultaneously, right?
Yeah, very much so. So I danced pretty much every day up until I was 15, ballet training. So I'd stopped just before hitting the professional mark.
Is that what, even before 15, is that what you had hoped to do, or was acting always sort of the primary goal?
I think I thought maybe I could do both, and I didn't have to decide, which now I'm sort of like, well, yeah, of course I didn't have to decide. I was so young.
Right.
But I think I thought maybe there was a way to do both because I liked them both equally and I couldn't decide. And then when I was 15, when you've been ballet, that's around the age when you start professionally, 16-ish, 17. And so I had to decide, and it became clear as life became more sort of realistic that I couldn't do both.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that was presented to me, I had to sort of choose between, and it was like, okay, well, the one I could envision giving up is ballet, mm-hmm. and I couldn't envision giving up acting.
Is it correct you graduated 15 from high school? Is that something I read?
Yes, with my GED. So it doesn't,
So still pretty, early
but
on.
I would like to make sure everyone doesn't think I'm some sort of genius. I basically got out of there early.
Well, and so for the years between then and then 19, which is when I think you went to New York, what was going on?
Well, I started West Wing when I was 17. And I think I did Girl Interrupted when I was 16.
So that was all still when you were living in LA.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, and I did, sort of, I think the odd movie thing here and there, everything that, say, you see it all on my IMDb, always like, I forget that I was in that movie.
Right.
Yeah, and then 17, I started The West Wing and did that until I was 19, moved to New York, and then I think picked up back on The West Wing once I was in New York.
So how did The West Wing begin? And when it crossed your radar, did you realize this was a big deal, or was it just another one of these IMDb credits, as you said?
Yeah, I knew it was a big deal because it was a big NBC show. I just had never had any luck getting pilots. Mad Men was the first pilot I ever did. I just didn't seem to fit into anybody's idea of someone who should be in their show. So when I got called into audition for The West Wing, I was thrilled because it was such a smart project and such great material, and obviously hadn't premiered yet though, so we didn't know that it was going to be as successful as it was. And Aaron Sorkin was this brilliant writer, and I went and auditioned for three times, and I thought there was just no way they were going to pick me because they sort of never picked me for television shows like that. And I guess it just must have finally found my path. And the last audition I did was I went in and I read with this guy, and he seemed really nice, and he was a really fast talker, and he seemed to know a lot about the show. And then later I found out that was Aaron Sorkin that I read with.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
So we'll remind people that you played Zoe Bartlett, the first daughter, and Sorkin dialogue is famously intricate, and also he expects it to be delivered exactly as written. How did you adjust to that? Had you ever had anything like that before?
No, certainly not. But at the same time, I was such a young actress that I thought one was supposed to know one's lines,
yes.
And I assumed you were supposed to know it word for word, and I didn't have the balls to change it. So it wasn't foreign to me. It was sort of like, well, yeah, obviously I should know it word for word. And it was only later that I kind of learned that was maybe unusual or not what everybody wanted. It was more that it was very fast and very smart. And I didn't even have the most intricate bits, you know. But yeah, I just something about his rhythm and something about his style, I fit in with really well.
Were you also, I'm trying to remember, we did have Allison Janney on here recently, and she was saying that the walk-in talks were complex but fun. I guess, were you spared walk-in talks? Or was you had some of those?
I did have a couple. Yeah. I did, and they were so fun.
Yeah.
Oh, it was like a play.
Yeah.
You know, it was like theater. It was great. It was all choreographed and on Steadicam, and you just did it, you know, 30 times, and you'd just wait in your little corner or your little hallway or wherever, and like you'd hear the, you know, what was often like a herd of elephants coming towards you with the camera and the spotter and everybody and the mic and everybody coming, and then you'd start jump in and do your bit, and then you'd be left behind. It was super fun. And you never, especially me as such a young gun, you never wanted to be the person who messed it up.
Yeah, right. So with that show, I guess technically were you classified as a recurring character? So what I actually wonder is that in some ways even harder than being a regular, because you have to come in and, as you say, you know, hit your mark or do your line and not screw it up. And you also only have such a limited relative to being a regular, limited opportunity to shine. So you've got to knock it out when you do it, right?
Absolutely. And it's why I have so much empathy for any reoccurring character that comes on to, you know, Handmaids or even Mad Men, because I understand how scary it is. And you're walking into a family that really knows each other and they've been there every day. And, you know, it's difficult to fit in. And there's also this kind of terrifying pressure of, technically, if you don't do a good enough job, they can absolutely not ask you back.
Yeah, yeah.
And every time you don't get asked back for a few episodes, you're pretty sure that you totally messed up, you know, and they hate you. So yeah, it's a scary place to be in. It's actually much easier to work on something every day.
Interesting. Well, because it wasn't full-time in the sense that a regular role would be, were you doing a lot of other jobs during West Wing, or what else was going on in your life at that time?
What was I doing? I mean, I started to do theater, so I moved to New York and did a play off-Broadway, and then I think I just started either auditioning for things and then occasionally doing a lot of independent films.
Yeah.
So I did a ton of just tiny movies, which was really, you know, at the time was amazing because I got to sort of practice and cut my teeth on all these films that, you know, a lot of people haven't even seen, but I just got to practice, you know.
Well, there was one that was during the run, and the name eludes me right now, but you got, I guess, your first film recognition with the Indie Spirit Award. What was that?
Virgin. Yeah. I did that when I was 20, I think.
Did that feel like an important one along the way?
Yeah, it really, really did. It oddly set me on this trajectory of the kinds of characters I would play and the kind of material I was looking for. And it showed me, I think, what I was maybe good at, which was really, really dark stuff.
Yeah.
And it was oh my gosh, I think the budget was $65,000.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And we made it in 21 days. And I worked every day, obviously, and it was a crazy script.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was very cool because, yeah, then we got nominated for John Cassavetes Award at the Independent Spirit Awards, and then I got nominated as well the year that Charlize Theron was doing Monster.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it was a very kind of formative experience.
So as the West Wing was coming to an end, was that a upsetting thing, or were you excited to go out and do other things? What did you imagine those next few years were going to look like?
Well, right before or after, I think the pilot for Mad Men and my last episode of The West Wing happened, I think, within a month of each other.
Wow.
Yeah, so I went and did my last episode, which was John Spencer's character's funeral.
Yeah.
And obviously that was very emotional for so many reasons. And I was very proud to be a part of that episode. I adored that man. He was just a really wonderful person, mm-hmm. brilliant actor. So it was a meaningful way to have an ending to that show for me. And then I think it was afterwards that I did the pilot for Mad Men.
Just for people who aren't in the business, the fact that there was a pilot, you had been cast in the pilot, so you had been, what, you had auditioned during West Wing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And that wasn't like too much going on. I mean, I guess you kept going for auditioning for a lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's a great thing about a reoccurring character is you can go do other things. So, yeah, I wasn't on the West Wing that much at that point.
Right.
So,
because you had survived the kidnapping of season 4.
Yeah.
And that was gone off to college, I think.
Yeah,
right?
I forget.
But anyway, so with Mad Men, though, understanding that you were cast in the pileup just as The West Wing was coming to an end. How did it first, before then, when it wasn't your part yet, cross your radar? It was a really hot script in town, the pilot, I remember, Matt Weiner's. And I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have... How does somebody think, you know, seeing Zoe Bartlett, how did they see Peggy Olson in Zoe Bartlett?
I really don't know. I think I had to prove it to them and to Matt. If I remember correctly, I don't think Matt had necessarily felt that me being on The West Wing was a good thing for him, if I remember right. And similarly to, you know, Top of the Lake, Jane Campion didn't necessarily, it wasn't because I played Peggy that I got that role.
Right.
So anyways, I had to go in and I auditioned at least twice. And if I also remember correctly, I think I was one of the first people to audition.
He says, the first day of audition, second person to read.
Yes, yes.
Quote, she came in and she was so young, wearing this ingenue dress with her hair long and straight. And all of a sudden, I just saw Peggy. She was just complete in every way, close quote. What do you remember about that first day with Matt?
Yeah, it's funny because I've seen my audition. And we had a little party near the end of the show at Matt's house. And he showed us all of our auditions.
That's awesome.
Which was crazy.
Yeah.
And I have the DVD somewhere. And I've seen my audition. And it's insane to me that anyone looking at me would ever think that I could play Peggy. I look like I just walked off the beach in Southern California. I'm tan, weirdly.
Right.
I have long blonde hair. I'm wearing like this really cute little like slightly revealing dress that I remember at the time was like my audition dress.
Right, right.
I loved that dress. You know, it was some cheap dress. Right. But I look so far from Peggy.
Right.
You couldn't even imagine. I look like I should be on the OC, not like Mad Men. But if you watch the performance, mm-hmm. it's almost exactly what's in the show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty much just a direct transference. I just look different.
So what does that say? You had already... something in the script you had connected to?
Yeah, I really did. I just, the best way I can describe it is, it often sounds a bit simplistic, but that I just felt like I knew her.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like I knew her, and I didn't know why or what that was, but I just could see who she was inside, and it just felt like a perfect fit from the very beginning.
Well, for anyone who's been living under a rock for the last decade, because it literally just is the decade anniversary, when the first episode went on the air, Peggy started as obviously the secretary at the ad agency in the 60s and worked her way up. And I wonder what that was like when you're coming off, starting with the pilot, but going forward, you're coming off Sorkin dialogue, which is like a mile a minute.
Yeah.
And here the pacing is just so different and deliberate, and what Matt obviously had in mind. But just how did you acclimate? How was it even described to you what he was looking for?
Yeah, it kind of wasn't. I kind of just got it. And Matt and I actually have talked about this, that we didn't even speak about the character for years. Occasionally we would get on the phone for hours and we would talk about the show and different things, and we would talk about the character in sort of a, like, as if she was a friend, but there was never any play it like this or play it like that or this is who she is. I think we both kind of understood that for whatever reason I got who he wrote,
mm-hmm.
and that shouldn't be tampered with, and you got to be careful with that, mm-hmm. you know? If you talk too much about something, it can ruin it.
Right.
So it wasn't ever explained to me. I just understood it, and I had been a fan of, like, all the movies that he referenced before the pilot.
What were some of those?
The Apartment,
okay.
Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah.
There were these movies that he was, like, kind of asked people to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I've seen all of those. So I was so familiar with that kind of, that era. And
yeah.
I was familiar with that kind of writing. And it just, it felt right. It just felt really right from the very beginning. There was so much humor in it as well, which was very much, which was the similarity between that and West Wing.
Yeah.
There was such an intelligent sense of humor. So I think West Wing set me up really well for that.
So the first season starts rolling out, puts AMC on the map, which really prior to that was like old movies with commercials.
Yeah.
Puts all of you guys on the map in a different way than ever before.
Yeah.
Why do you think it clicked as much as it did, and how quickly did it change your life on a day-to-day way?
I mean, I think that people were really starting to ask for intelligent television, and it had already started with, you know, The Shield mm-hmm. and The Wire and then Sopranos. And it had already started, but people were really asking for it. And they'd gotten it on their sort of premium cable. Mm-hmm. But I think people were just starting to realize that audiences were really smart mm-hmm. and they appreciated good work. And so it just kind of came at the right time. And there was just, there's no one thing that made Mad Men successful. It was everything. You know, I always talk about how if the cinematography hadn't been great, it wouldn't have worked. Mm-hmm. If the sets had been terrible and cheap, cheesy looking, mm-hmm. it wouldn't have worked. If the costumes looked like costumes, it would have been distracting. It was every single element, every single department that came together to do some of their best work, backed by writing and great acting. So it was just, it was really everybody, and all of our directors always were top notch and amazing. And it's not a solo sport, this.
And as people were responding to all of those great elements, including your performance, what was the first sort of recognition for you that this was clicking?
I suppose the first summer we aired, I was in New York for some reason, and I started to see these ads in the subways. And I had been living in New York, and all of a sudden there were ads in my subways. And then I guess it wasn't honestly until the Golden Globes of that year, because we were so brand new, and we had, you know, we'd gotten great reviews, but the ratings weren't great. So, you know, we just didn't know. And we thought maybe we had a small audience. And then all of a sudden, it was the year that the writer strikes. So, so there weren't actually any Golden Globes.
Oh, my God. They did on TV. They did a press conference, right?
Yes. Yeah. So we had a party at the Chateau Marmont.
Okay.
And we were on the balcony. And John won.
Yeah.
And that was, you'd never heard a more shocked group in your life. Yeah. I mean, everyone was just absolutely shocked. And then... we won. Yeah. And it was just the biggest surprise of all of our lives. I mean, it was like the years of Grey's Anatomy. Right. And like, it was just, you just didn't think that was ever going to happen. So that was kind of the first real inkling of, okay, I think we're going to come back.
And were you, prior to Mad Men, were you, you know, you want to go to the supermarket or whatever, would you be basically unbothered? And now that changed? Or how, like, no. On a personal level, was it different?
It was so much slower than that.
Yeah.
Because the audience of our show was always a little bit small.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it took years for that to kind of be a thing that started happening. And I also look really different from the character.
Right.
So, no, it took years for that to be a thing. Very gradual.
At the outset, did you know how huge a character Peggy was going to be throughout the run of the show? Because you were always second in the credits after John, but at the same time, I know you've said you were not necessarily second on the call sheets, and plenty of people who people assumed were, like, you know, integral characters of the show would, in one way or another, drop off over the years. So were you always aware that Peggy would be there at the end?
No. Not at all. I knew I'd signed a contract, so I knew I, unless they fired me, I'd be around. But no, I really didn't. And I think it's interesting because I think it's a combination of things. I think Matt, you know, knew that he was going to have her character rise up to be more than a secretary, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think the level of it and the way that she became, I think, such a partner for Don was something that maybe was developed a little bit more organically over time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was a combination of the two. I certainly didn't think about it. When I saw my name as second in the credits, I remember when I first like saw our opening credits and it was second, I was very surprised. I was like, nobody had told me, and I was like, that's weird.
You didn't feel at that point like you were the
number
two?
No, I thought four was a very like appropriate number. Yeah. So no, I had no idea, and I really, really didn't. I mean, every season I honestly was very, like, consistently so pleased with everything that I got to do.
When I moved out here to LA about 6 years ago, I struck up a kind of weird Harold and Maude friendship with this woman who's now 90 years old. Her name is Marcia Nassiter. She was a secretary in the 60s who became the first female vice president of a studio in Hollywood. Oh. She helped to make Rocky and Coming Home and a lot of great movies. And I, as I was getting to know her, we Mad Men somehow came up, and she said she had started to watch it, but it was too painful. She said, I lived it. And so I wondered for you if there were any people like that who had sort of experienced what Peggy went through, who you knew about, who you consulted, anything like that.
No, not really, honestly. I mean, as a, you know, somewhat intelligent person, I was aware of things that had happened and was aware of what women had done in the workplace. So I, no. And I didn't want to tell anybody's story in particular either. I wanted to tell her story, and right. I wanted her to be an individual. And I just didn't have any problem imagining what that was like or putting myself in her shoes, you know. I was close enough to being an adolescent that I understood the idea of being insecure and feeling awkward and not knowing what your place was. So it just didn't take that much for me to make that leap, yeah. You know.
There are so many great episodes that I could ask you about, but I want to ask you just about one that's sort of a microcosm, I think, and that is The Suitcase. This is season 4, episode 7, and it basically centers around Don and Peggy, and many thought it was the best episode up to that point, and it's just a good excuse to ask you about working with John Hamm, who I think you had more scenes with probably than anyone else, and just what that working relationship was like, and if you took anything particularly away from it.
Yeah, that episode is my favorite as well, and I think that it was this beautiful moment in time where it was pretty much just John and I all the time, and so it was kind of quiet, like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It yeah. just was kind of like relaxed and nice, and John and I were very good friends at that point, and it was just, I think, a great example of why television is so awesome, because you can spend 4 years mm-hmm. waiting, or three and a half years waiting for this moment, and you can build it up. You couldn't have done it in season 2, no. You know, you needed that time, and it's just, that's why I love television. That's why my heart's really in television, is because I love that you can create that suspense. And it was a beautiful thing. We just kind of we work really well together.
Yeah.
We're very, very close friends, and we understand each other. We understand the way that the other person works. There's a huge amount of mutual respect and admiration. So it kind of couldn't have been more perfect, honestly. And over the years, I think, as well as we've gotten to know each other even more, our relationship has deepened in the same way that Don and Peggy's has. Yeah. You know, I think that obviously there's a little bit less of a mentor protege,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
because that would be a little condescending of him.
Right.
But there is that element of father, daughter, or older brother, younger sister, you yeah. know? And so exploring that in that episode, things weren't that far off from reality a lot of
wow.
the time. Yeah,
that's
it was
great.
Really interesting.
So generally speaking, how far ahead of the viewer were you in terms of knowing the plot? And when in the process did you know what the ending was going to be for Peggy?
Mm. I knew the end of Mad Men for like 5 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You're a good secret keeper.
I am. That's whenever anyone tells me a secret, I have to say to them, I have to prove to them that I'm going to keep it. I tell them
you
that.
You tell them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I am a very good secret keeper.
Right.
So yeah, so I knew the Coca-Cola thing for 5 years. Yeah. But Peggy's end, I think, when did I know about her and Stan? I would say, at some point, I think at the beginning of that season,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was kind of something that I thought was going to happen.
Did you?
It had been, yeah, it had been, I could see it building up. I could see it becoming more and more obvious to me, but I didn't know how it was going to happen until I read the script. But I knew about that. I knew about that. And I had gotten wind as well that John and I, that our last scene, he was going to be on the road. Like, I knew a lot of that stuff at the beginning of the season.
What were your personal feelings, whether or not you would have expressed them to Matt, about the resolution, about her not going off with Joan, about her ending up with Stan?
Yeah.
You must have had your own opinion on this. What was it?
I loved it. Yeah. I thought that was exact. First of all, I have a huge amount of respect for the writer. It's his show. It's his vision. He's literally, it's like a novel. He's writing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how he sees these characters ending. That's how they end. Mm-hmm. There's no argument there. You know what I mean? There's no opinion here. Because you can walk around and ask a bunch of people how they think it should end.
Right.
And they're all going to say different things. Matt's writing the show, so he's going to write it. But that said, I really, really, really loved it. I thought that it was, I loved the idea of her going off with Joan. But I can see that's not, she's a writer. She's supposed to write. She mm-hmm. loves it. So I could see that's not she wouldn't have been able to do that with Joan. She would have had to give up writing. So that wasn't exactly right for her, I think. And I think that they'll end up working, they would have ended up working together anyways. You know? And then as far as Stan, I think the idea that Peggy actually finds love and has this chance for an amazing relationship is actually super punk rock, because it's like, it's not what you would think, because everyone, I think, expected her to take over the company. Mm-hmm. In the last episode, which is completely unrealistic.
Right.
She would have taken over the company in 1980, right. you know, or been creative right. director in 1980, right. just like Pete says,
right.
which is what happened.
Yep.
It was too early for her to have taken over the company in some major way or have taken Don's role or something. So I thought that I loved it.
And also, as I think you've said before, we kind of know that from a professional standpoint, she's going to be okay.
Yeah.
But you don't know
exactly.
romantically if she can swing it.
Exactly. And I think it blows the stereotype apart of like a driven woman who's very good at her job has to not have a great personal life.
Right.
Like that's obviously not true. So I think that was actually more subversive
yeah.
for her to end up with Stan than for her not to.
During hiatuses on between Mad Men, I mean, how long would those be generally?
They would be about, like, we shot for like 5 months. So about, yeah.
Have
five,
a good
six,
amount of time
yeah,
between.
Yeah, 6 months or so.
You would have been well within your rights to just lounge and not do anything, but you seems like you for one reason or another really push yourself. You went and did your Broadway debut, I think, in 2008. During that hiatus, you started Top of the Lake in one of those. What was the thought process? Just that you would get bored, or that you had specific, you know, there were a couple movies in there. Did you feel like, I want to keep open the not be thought of solely as a TV actress? Just mm-hmm. what was the rationale for these hiatus decisions?
I think all of that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, number one being I would have gotten bored.
Yeah.
For sure. You know, if you're playing one character for 5 months, you definitely want to try to play another mm-hmm. character for a little while. You know, I also am just still, you know, a working actress that wants to work.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like I was like hugely famous and a billionaire that could just like rest, you know, and I did have to work sometimes.
Right.
So I love working. It's my favorite thing. Everyone like knows me, knows that mm-hmm. that's like, I don't even like to say workaholic, because
yeah.
I actually have a really good relationship
yeah,
with
yeah.
work,
yeah.
but I do love it. So yeah, so it also gave me the opportunity, I think, to keep trying things and keep, you know, with like Top of the Lake. I didn't know if I could play anything else other than Peggy at a certain point. I thought I could,
mm-hmm.
but I kind of needed to prove it to myself as well. I think it was around season 5 that I did that, because it was around the same time that Peggy left the company.
Okay.
So Peggy left Sterling Cooper, and then I sort of went off on my adventure. It was all Mad Men has a really strange way of paralleling my life
yeah.
in personal ways that I will never talk about, but like it definitely parallels in a lot of professional ways
right.
as well.
Right.
So anyways, it was around season 5 that I think Peggy was really being solidified as mm-hmm. one of the, you know, leads of the show, and I was starting to get more well known for that
mm-hmm.
and being recognized for that, and so I needed to be able to prove to myself that I could do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was pretty smart of me,
yeah,
frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cuz it kind of set me up to also think that maybe I had a life post Mad Men.
You could
know?
Feel a little more confident.
Yeah, yeah. I could have failed miserably, and then I would have worked, I guess, the opposite. So, you know.
Well, but let's just contextualize for people who, again, maybe haven't seen all these things we're talking about. With Top of the Lake, this would have been 2013 that you did season 1. You're playing a detective who is in some way, I guess, investigating a case that provokes memories of some horrible things that happened to her as well. And this is for Jane Campion, who people will remember won an Oscar for The Piano.
Yeah.
And you've called it the most challenging role you've ever played. And this was even after Handmaids and everything. Somebody asked you and you said, that was and is, because it's now back, the most challenging role you've ever played and the biggest departure for you.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why. I mean, obviously there's accent, there's some other things involved, but what makes it the most challenging?
Yeah, I'm going to contradict myself slightly. I think that Handmaid's is actually the most challenging, but that Top of the Lake is the biggest departure, for
okay.
sure. Handmaid's was challenging in ways that we can get to,
mm-hmm.
being the two hats that I wore and the amount of time that I worked.
Yes.
But Top of the Lake was challenging because it was... It's just so different for me with the accent, with her body language, with the detective thing
yeah.
and having to do things that don't come naturally to
yeah.
me, like, you know, pulling a gun and looking tough. So that was definitely, yeah, that was, it's just, it's never felt, it's felt great playing her, but it's never felt easy or comfortable.
So it must have been pretty validating to, again, go to, actually, first of all, get to go to the Golden Globes that year. Not, you'd been on years, but to go and win for Top of the Lake is a, you know, must have, again, reiterated that you can do things outside of Mad Men in a nice way, right?
Yeah, for sure. It really, really did. That was just about the shock of my life. Yeah. I'll tell you that night. I was gunning for Helen Mirren. Yeah. I was like, that girl's got this. But she got the Screen Actors Guild Award. Yeah, she did okay. We didn't have to fight it out. Yeah, I was very, very surprised to win that. I never won anything before either. So I was like, I didn't know they actually gave them to you.
Give it another month or so. But, thank you. So, all right. So as Mad Men ended, the next thing that you were constantly asked was like, all right, how do you follow Mad Men? Which, again, as one of the great shows, I understand why people would wonder that. And I found it very interesting that, so you go to see Bryan Cranston in All the Way on Broadway playing Lyndon Johnson, which he did right after Breaking Bad ended. Mm-hmm. And I guess, what, you go backstage?
Yeah.
And what happened there?
My brother and I went backstage to say hi because I, you know, knew him a little bit.
Fellow AMC.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I'd seen him on the circuit, Christmas parties and such.
Yes.
And yeah, we were chatting afterwards. You know, I'm sure you've met him. He's like the nicest guy in the world. Actually, Vince Gilligan is actually the nicest guy in the world. And Ryan's like a very close second. But I was talking to him and you know, I was asking him how I was going with Breaking Bad being done. And he said, yeah, I come to do this play and it's kind of, he seemed to say, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but the impression that I got from him was that it seemed to be a really great palate cleanser and a really great way of letting go of an era and moving on to something completely different, because he changed not only roles, but he changed the medium. Mm-hmm. And that was the key. It was not just playing something different, but completely changing the way the muscles that you worked. Yeah. And so that was, I just never forgot it. And that's why I went after Mad Men. I did a few films and then Heidi Chronicles came along.
Revival.
And actually, I think I might have signed on to that before I finished Mad Men.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. Maybe it was like right afterwards. But I remember thinking about what Brian had done. I was like, whatever Brian does, I shall do.
Well, you were great. I went with my mother and you got a Tony nomination. So that was a cool thing. And then that was, as you say, a period when you started to, I guess, do movies again as well. So Meadowland, which will factor in with Handmaids in a way in a moment, but just at that point when you were thinking in terms of media, whatever the plural would be, was the idea that as far as TV, you were anticipating taking a longer break because you know, I guess just to mix it up, as you say, the reason you would do Broadway is something different, but like, did you ever imagine that you would be back on TV as soon as you've come back?
Not really, no. I think I knew that I would be back in television because after, it's all where all the good scripts are most of the time. And I was reading scripts and I was getting sent things. And I just felt like I always liked the television scripts better. So I knew it was going to happen at some point. And I had toyed with a couple of very, very good shows that were very difficult to kind of decide on. There's just so much good stuff out there. But I don't think I thought maybe it would be like another year, because I was also shooting the second season of Top of the Lake when I signed on to Handmaid's Tale.
Oh, that was before.
Yeah, that was before. Okay, I know everyone thinks it's after because it comes after, but like, no, it was actually before. They just had like a little bit more time than we had. A little more post-production time. I used to really rib Ari and Jane, our other director, because I would be like, you realize Gwen and I have gone and shot entire seasons of our television shows. They have been edited and they have aired before this will come out. But, you know, God bless them for having that time. I wish we all did.
Yes.
But yeah, so anyways, I think that I didn't think I was going to be on quite as soon, but probably within like a year, you know?
So now, what was the first awareness of Handmaid's Tale? I mean, maybe you knew the book existed, but that there was somebody trying to do it as a TV series. And also, why after that did it? It sounds like it took quite a while for you to get to yes. So what was, like, to the point where they were threatening, we're going to take it to somebody else. So how did that all go down?
Yeah, so they sent me, you know, as usual, you get an email from your agents with like some information and then the script attached. And I remember just knowing immediately I saw what it was and I was like, God damn it. Like, this is going to be good. This is going to be tough. I was familiar with the book. I knew it was prolific. I knew it was an amazing role and what a great idea and everything. And so I read the first episode and it was beautiful, so brilliant, as everyone else, you know, knows now. And Bruce has been nominated for an Emmy for it. And then, and I was like, fuck, because I thought, this is really good, and now I have a problem because now I have to figure out if I should do it. Right. And then so I asked for the second script because being somewhat versed in television, I know the second script can be hard.
Right.
And so I asked for the second one, and I read it, and I literally at the end was like, fuck, again, because it was so good, and it was almost better, and it was just like, it put me in a real pickle. And then I talked to Bruce on the phone, and we sort of fell in love.
This is, we should say, for Bruce Miller.
Yeah.
And had you been aware of him prior to this?
I suppose a little bit with previous work that he'd done, but I didn't know him or anything like that. I'd seen some of his shows, but I didn't really know him.
So he was the only name attached to the material at that point, or was Warren Littlefield already also?
No, it was just Bruce.
Okay.
So I talked to Bruce, and him and I like fell in love, and I was in Australia, and we talked for like an hour, and it was just great, and he just said all the right things, and I just was like, this is a guy I think I could like get along with. And then I really needed to make sure that it was going to be what I thought it was going to be, what I wanted it to be. I talked to somebody at Hulu, and then eventually
it was already clear that this was going to Hulu?
Yes, it was already at Hulu. Yeah, it was already picked up. It was already at Hulu for 10 episodes.
I got to quickly ask, because this was something I was wondering. Did you have a Hulu subscription before this show?
I think I did you actually. Really? I think I did.
Because I think so many people are now getting it because of you guys. Totally. But I wondered if you...
I think I did because of the Mindy Project.
Okay.
Because I was a big fan of the Mindy Project. Right. So I think I did because of that.
Right.
And by the way, I still pay for Hulu.
Guys, what are you doing? Comp the poor lady.
They have. They gave me a free year subscription. But I don't know how to like cancel my old one. Put the new one in.
Guys.
So occasionally I'll get like a notification that like your Hulu subscription is like been, you know, redone for the month, and it makes me laugh every time.
Well,
so they're getting
a good cause.
Yeah, yes. They're getting my like $11.99 like every month because I do without commercials.
Version, you do
of
get
course.
With commercials or without? Without, okay.
Yeah, absolutely without. Okay. I'm not scripting. Yeah. I was literally watching Hulu last night, by the way. I was watching Real Housewives.
There you go.
anyway, so I talked to Hulu and they were great. And then I talked to Warren.
Okay. Who had now come on in capacity?
He had come on in a sort of a capacity of like, we wanted to make sure that there was somebody who had that experience in television.
And we'll say, if I guess we can just refer people to that episode of this podcast, but Warren Littlefield ran NBC in the must-see TV 90s and then has been a producer of stuff like Fargo since then.
Yeah, and Fargo was my favorite TV show.
Really?
Yes. So I said, what about the guy who did Fargo?
So that's how he came about?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was already interested in it. Right. Like, I think he had already been talking to them about it. And then I said, what about Warren Littlefield?
Now, you're saying this before you had committed to doing the part? Or
Really? Before.
Because that was going to be part of what it took to get you to sign on.
Yeah.
But also, when along the line did it become part of what it was going to take for you that you would also be a producer?
Oh, that was a very easy. That was, they offered it to me. I would have asked anyways.
Right.
That was in the initial offer.
So right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And why was that important to you? Obviously, I mean, I can imagine, but I wonder for you.
Because if you're going to, I think, be the face of a show and so much is going to be riding on your shoulders, you have to take responsibility for that. And I needed to have some control and I needed to have a say. And I had been on a show for 7 seasons.
Yeah.
And so I had learned quite a bit. And then Top of the Lake. So I felt like I was at a point when I could start to learn a little bit more and broaden my own horizons a little bit. And then, it's just about having a little bit of say.
And just to illustrate some of what producers do on top of your responsibilities as the star of the show, what were I've read a lot of the different things that you contributed as a producer. Can you share some of the more interesting ones?
Yeah. So honestly, from the very beginning to the very bitter end.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it was a lot of casting and finding directors.
Including Reed.
Who
you, again, just to remind people, acted for in Meadowland.
Yes.
2 years ago, something like that.
Yes, something like that. I'd done a cameo in Meadowland. We had become friends before that.
Oh, okay.
And that's why she asked me to do Meadowland.
I get it.
Through a mutual friend of ours, my best friend, mm-hmm. who worked on Looking, and then Reed did Looking, et cetera, et cetera. Small world. So yeah, so Reed came up for the show, and I played it real cool because there's a real kind of, you got to be careful with that kind of thing because you don't want to push too hard for your friend because it can backfire mm-hmm. and it can seem like you're just pushing for them because you're your friend.
Right.
So I really wanted, I vouched for her and I suggested her. I brought her up, but I also just wanted to make sure that it was like everyone really, it wasn't forced on them.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then, so Warren signed on and then we were casting, looking for directors, department heads, just every little thing down to the color of the costume, mm-hmm. different casting choices later on. I mean, it's almost difficult for me to even tell you what
it was.
Because it could almost be easier to say what it wasn't like.
Right.
Because it was just everything. And I think the biggest thing that I was involved in that I didn't realize or didn't think about the fact that I was going to be involved in was in post-production.
Just giving notes on all the episodes and
exactly.
everything.
Exactly, and seeing cuts, and I've seen every episode 10 million times and scenes more than that, and watching all the dailies, and that I didn't realize I was going to be such a big part of.
How do you like that aspect of it? Some actors and actresses say, you know, I'll never watch a performance that I gave or whatever. Here you better be, right?
Yeah,
so
totally.
So how do you like that?
I thought I would have a problem with it. I thought it might be weird, but you kind of just get over it really quickly.
Yeah.
You just switch hats. You're not really watching yourself all the time either. You're watching the shot and you're watching this and that and you're trying to keep track of what's happening. And so it's not like you're watching your performance.
Right.
And it's weird. But I also, I was one of those people who didn't like watching myself, but just because I found it boring, not because I was going to be upset about it, but just because I was like, why would I want to sit around watching myself?
Why do you think it is that this show, which was rolling out until June 14th, so it's all still pretty fresh for everybody, certainly relative to the other shows that we're talking about this year. Why do you think people have connected to the show and to your performance on such a deep level? You've seen big connections to shows and people that you've been a part of, you know, involved with before, but this, to me, I think it feels different. I wonder if you agree.
I do. I really do. It does feel different. It feels different to me. It felt different playing it. And the responses definitely felt different. The responses felt so personal from people. Even from the very beginning, we were still shooting the show in January, and we sent like the first 3 episodes out to television critics. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very rough, and it was really, really terrifying. I know people get to see them in even rougher cuts. Mm-hmm. But that early, but it was just terrifying to send them out so soon. And then this there was a sort of incredible response from the critics. And we went to the TCAs in January, which is where you go and you talk to all the critics. And I'm explaining it to your audience, not to you.
Absolutely, thank you.
And it just felt like they got it. And if they were talking about it as if it was like, as if they had worked on the show. It was so personal to them. It was like they were a part of it. And that was the first kind of like, wow, I think people really got what we tried to do. And then the response from the audience, it's felt much more personal than anything I've ever done. And I think the reason why is the reason why I signed on and the reason why I connect to that character more than any character I've ever played. I think there's a basic thing, no matter who you are, race, color, creed, of survival, and you want to survive, and freedom, and the idea of freedom, and the idea of your own rights as a human, wherever you are. And I think that is something that people really connect to. I think it's obviously something people very much connect to right now.
Well, that's where I want to actually go next, because a lot of people that find out that this show was actually kind of essentially for the very most part in the can prior to November 8th, 2016, they're surprised to hear that, because it feels in some ways like a response to what's happened since then.
Totally.
And I wonder for you, just first of all, where you were and what went down on November 8th for you personally, and then also how you think the show has been impacted by that, because I wonder if the show would have generated a noticeably different reaction had the outcome on November 8th been different.
Yeah, so we were on episodes 4 and 5 out of 10, but they had almost all been written. And obviously, when you do a TV show, even if the script for the last episode isn't written, there's an outline. Everyone mm-hmm. knows what's going to happen. So yeah, it was pretty much all formed. And then obviously based on the book written in 1985.
Right.
So that was formed. We went and watched the election that night. I remember Reed was in town because she was doing a scene that we hadn't gotten. And so me and her and OT and a few people went and watched the election. And then at a certain point, I gave up and went home because I had to get up really early mm-hmm. the next morning. Mm-hmm. And sort of but stayed up till like 2:30 in the morning refreshing my computer.
So you knew what was going
yeah, exactly. on. Yeah, exactly. And then I went to work the next day, and it was odd. We shoot in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it was a very strange feeling. It was as if everyone knew something really bad had happened to you but didn't really know what they should say about mm-hmm. it. And we did a couple scenes that day, Joe and I. Joseph Fiennes, who plays the commander, and he had a couple of really key lines from the book, and one of them is better never means better for everyone. It always means worse for some, mm-hmm. which is Margaret's mm-hmm. line from the book.
Yeah.
And I just remember being, you know, obviously so struck by that in that moment on that day. And yeah, so as far as, you know, the, I think, parallels between the show and what's happening, obviously, we would prefer for it not to be that, you know? We really would. Right. We'd rather it be like, wow, what is this crazy world of Gilead?
Right.
That would be much more interesting for us. But here we are. And obviously, these are themes that are deep-rooted, not only in our country. And, you know, the fact that people have found some strength in, you know, seeing themselves reflected back at themselves is something I think that we're very honored
yeah
about.
People have commented on the flashback to when June and all of her female colleagues are fired because it's mandated, especially because you carrying out all of your belongings in the box, I guess they, for a lot of people, it feels particularly shitty after everyone had enjoyed much the moment when you're carrying your box into McCann Erickson
yes.
in Mad Men, which is the most gift moment of all time with your cigarette dangling
yes.
and all that.
How is that not a meme?
I've
never made this connection
before. You did it?
Okay,
well, I gotta tell you,
that's
I was just
amazing.
Thinking, like, it just is the ultimate hitting home of almost, like, society, how backwards things have moved recently, I think.
Totally.
And we see it all in your face, I mean, in these two moments.
Yeah.
So I just wondered, I don't even know if there's a question there, but I just have to say it. Really, that was striking to see the same person. I mean, imagine somebody's watching, catching up with Mad Men now and then goes and sees you.
It yeah, just... absolutely. And I mean, that's what I think that's what we're facing, and that's what we're looking at, this sort of incredible reversal
right.
in fortune and this reversal
right.
of rights that right. is just shocking. You know, and I, but that's really, it's, I don't know why I've never actually made the specific box connection before,
well,
but that's very interesting.
We'll make a GIF today and
yeah,
we'll go viral.
If you can, that would be great. Thank you. Whoever gets there first
yes,
wins.
Yes. So why is it that, what is it about Offred, or I guess she would prefer to still be called June, that allows her to remain defiant even as people try to beat her down and as is maybe... you know, her defiance, I guess, is maybe best manifested in that Nolite te bastardes carborundorum.
Very good.
Well, we're leaving out the punchline.
Yes.
Bitches. I mean, somebody in that situation to even be able to fire up that kind of FU, where do you think that's coming from in her?
I think that women are incredibly strong and moms are incredibly strong. And, you know, it's a very old idea, the way that a mother lion will protect her cub. And I think that, you know, there's all those stories of women finding that superhuman strength to lift the car, you know, when their child is trapped under. I think that we as people as well have a lot of untapped strength that can come out when we need it. And I think that June finds that in the interest of finding her daughter mm-hmm. and getting her family back. I don't know if she would do that for herself, but it is her daughter that actually keeps her alive because she can't give up until she gets her back or at least knows that she's safe,
yep.
even if they're not reunited. So it's her love. It's, for me, this show is so much about love, and it's her love for her family that actually keeps her going, keeps her alive. And I've seen many incredible women all around the world survive such intense horrors and violations. And, you know, we've been lucky to hear their stories and after their survival. And I think that, you know, June has that in her, this person who just will not give up.
Right.
And that's what I love about it.
And
the
I think
most.
A lot of people, I mean, that's exactly. Clearly there's this connection.
It's
so.
Inspiring, yeah. You know, it's inspiring to me. Yeah. I mean, I look up to her in that way, you know.
With our last few minutes here, I just want to do a couple of big picture things, if we may.
Sure.
I read that you tend to have your headphones on listening to music between takes on shows going back for years.
Yeah.
So what was sort of the most played song for West Wing, Mad Men, and now Handmaids?
Gosh, I don't know if I did it when I was in West Wing. I was so young then, so I'm not sure if I'd gotten into it at that point. For me, Mad Men was probably, I was very, and I still am, but I definitely was discovering Sigur Rós, okay. This Icelandic band.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was probably Sigur Rós, but I couldn't pick a particular song, mainly because I have a bad memory. Top of the Lake, did you ask that one, or you wanted to know
Handmaids?
That's
going to sub in for West Wing, so let's
okay, perfect. Top of the Lake definitely would have been Sigur Rós, I have to say, and then a little bit of Eminem.
Okay.
Yeah, which I know is an odd choice.
That's
but,
just interesting.
Yes, and then Handmaids, my God. If there's like one, so hard. There's another Icelandic artist named Ólafur Arnalds,
okay.
And he has done incredible albums on his own, but he also has done soundtracks, and he did Broadchurch.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a couple of tracks on that that I would say would probably be the biggest, particularly one called Beth's Theme that is just heartbreaking. And so there's a couple of songs, and actually they're both his, that I can put on when I really need them.
All right.
You know what I mean? And okay. Will really sort of connect me to a more emotional place.
Nice.
Yeah.
You've received a Best Actress in a Drama Series Emmy nomination for The Handmaid's Tale. This is your 8th overall, 7th in this category. We looked, only 5 women in history have more in this category nominations. What does it mean to you to you know, be nominated, and then what would it mean to you to actually take one of these puppies home? Are you one of a lot of people, you know, oh, I keep my Oscar in the bathroom. Or
right,
whatever.
Right, right.
But like, I don't believe that from anybody. So
I know. Yeah. Unless those people have like 5
yeah,
Oscars.
Maybe, yeah, Meryl maybe. But
yeah,
like,
totally.
Yeah, yeah.
What would it mean to me to win or to get nominated?
Well, so what has it meant to pick up 8 of these? And
oh,
then
yeah.
To, yeah, sure.
I feel like, honestly, I never in my life could have ever thought that I would have 8 nominations. That is insane to me. And I feel like as far as that goes, I 8 at 35 is pretty good. And I think
so.
That, yeah, I feel like 8 maybe equals winning one. So like I don't know how many you have to get nominated
right.
for to like equal
right.
one win.
Right.
But I feel pretty satisfied.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that. That okay. I feel like 8 is like beyond what I could have ever expected. It just really, really is. So, and then, especially for like 3 different roles,
yeah,
you know?
That's amazing.
So I'm kind of good in that department.
Yeah.
I really am not like asking for anything more,
right.
quite genuinely.
Yeah.
As far as winning, it would mean so much to me, obviously. I agree with you where I'm not gonna say that it wouldn't. Of course it would, because the category is so amazing.
Yeah, it's
incredible if you look at that category, and it's been like that every year that I've been nominated.
Mm-hmm.
When you have these women who I have seen every single one of their performances and think they're brilliant, and they inspire me to do better. So for me, the win would be I just couldn't believe that I was necessarily better than any of those women.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, is I just think that we all, that every character, every performance that they've given is so incredible. So for me, that would be the crazy part of it.
Now, you're also nominated as a producer of the series, which
yeah.
is nominated for Best Drama Series, which would be kind of an amazing thing in itself, because for years, everybody's been aware of, oh, Netflix and Amazon, and they do great things, but
yeah.
if Hulu wins a series award before either of them, that's like, that's the biggest upset of all time. And it would be an amazing. So you already put AMC on the map. So that can be your, you know, your side
totally.
Career, putting networks on the map.
No, it kind of is.
Yeah.
AMC and Sundance TV and now Hulu.
Yeah.
So that's my pitch as a producer when I go in and try to pitch a project.
Right.
I very unabashedly,
right.
without shame, tell them that I would like to put them on the map.
That's good. You should. Home Shopping Network, she's coming
exactly.
next.
Exactly.
So
I'm going to to make you.
Right. And then finally, I know you've got a number of exciting things that are rolling out. We mentioned season 2 of Top of the Lake. You were in the movie The Square That Won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. And I read that you may be doing a third with Alex Ross Perry, who you've made. These are some of the indies that we referred to earlier.
Yeah.
So if the rest of your career had to closely resemble some other, you know, someone else's, who would that be and why?
Actually, someone I mentioned earlier, Helen Mirren, probably. Yeah. I think, I mean, she's one of my absolute favorites. And I've met her, and she's very, very cool, broad. Mm-hmm. And I just think that she's done a very perfect mix of television, film, and theater as well.
Yeah.
And really excelled in each medium. And she's one of those actresses that you almost don't know which you would put her in as being sort of the most famous for.
Yeah.
Because you could easily say with all her theater work that she's a theater actress, you know.
Well, for just one part, she won the Oscar, Emmy, and Tony. So
exactly.
That's just amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so that exact kind of thing, I think, is awesome. So that, I look up to that kind of career.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I would bet on you. I think it was great.
You.
So thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.